as we continue our conversation this week with Jeanette.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
So we were talking about listening. So clearly listening is very, very important. I think also if you're speaking with a neurodivergent person, pay attention to how they want to interact with you. For example, there are things like eye contact that we all measure as you're engaged with me. Some functioning adults that are autistic that actually have great careers say that when I look straight at someone, I can't see their face. I have face blindness, which is a thing. So I look over here, and if I look at you from my peripheral vision, I can see your face. So it's not that I'm disengaged. Don't be hurt. Don't be insulted. So pay attention and don't make assumptions based upon your neurotypical habits and patterns.
Yeah.
Really go, okay, then think how much you're talking. Are you talking too fast where they can't process what you're saying? Give people a moment to pause. And then also another way is that, so you learn how they communicate. So if they would rather not talk, and there are a lot of people that are nonverbal, then you find out, do they email? Do they text? Because they may prefer that, and you can still have a relationship in a way that works for them. Also, if you don't know what to do, talk to the people that know that person maybe better than you do. And they're going to have lots of hints and tips. Possibly, if they meet with you, they may not want to meet in a noisy coffee shop. They may want to sit outside because they can't stand the noise. So it's all these little things that seem little, but it makes such a difference, one, in how they feel. Because I think something that is not true in my experience, and I wish I could say there was research. I don't know if there is. I don't know about it. But in my experience, people that are neurodivergent or even on the autism spectrum or are OCD or have ADHD want relationship. Now, that may not look like what it would look like for us as neurotypical people, but they still want relationship. So we just have to accept what that means to them and then go at it from there. I think also know your limits in a situation. Because I think we all feel afraid. I think that the places where we can feel most afraid when dealing with people is if they don't talk and we don't have a clear path to communication. If they have sometimes behaviors that we don't understand, whether that be rocking to calm themselves or flapping, and you can see some of those kinds of things across a variety of neurodivergent things that people experience, that you just try to ignore those. Or ask, say, hey, why do you do that? And often people will tell you, it just makes me feel better. I go, okay. And you know what? I've been in situations where I rocked.
Yeah.
Because it made me feel better. You know, that's okay. But also know your limitations. You don't need to be afraid. And I think fear is so huge. And then when there's behavioral, like acting out behavior, we step away because we're so afraid and we don't know what to do. We're afraid of making a mistake. We're afraid of insulting a parent. We're just afraid. We're just afraid. And so I think that if we're in a loving frame of mind, then that can cast out our fear. God kind of promises that to us. And I think we just go with what we can do and don't expect ourselves to do everything. But mostly, just approach. Don't be afraid. An axiom that I learned a long time ago is that all behavior is communicative, meaning that even a typically developing child, a neurotypical child throws a tantrum, they're telling you something. What are they telling me? Am I too hungry? We're running errands so long, I didn't get my nap. What are they telling you? And then we adjust our behavior. Well, I think that's going to be the same that's true for other big explosive behaviors that can happen. I think you got to learn how to keep yourself safe and how to keep them safe, but it doesn't mean you need to be afraid of them, because generally there's a trigger that had nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's an internal state. It's not, they're not lashing out at you. They're just, it's an internal process of explosion.
Yeah.
So
what are signs to look for if you think you have a neurodivergent child? They're young. It's your first kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's hard, and that's very complex.
It's very broad,
Very broad, very complex. I think the first thought I would start with is that in yourself as a parent as you reflect, because often if things aren't going the way you hope they would, or if things haven't gone the way you're used to, say based on your other kids, or if things aren't going with what you expected before you gave birth, if this is your first child, then you've got to examine that and go, am I on track or not? Because sometimes people can think that their children aren't okay because they're not like their other kids. And they may be just fine. They're just not their other kids. We have two daughters who are so different from each other. It's as if they had different families. I mean, but that because they were born that way, and they've been that way ever since they were babies, ever since birth. And so to acknowledge that and go, so, because what you want to avoid is have your concern look super anxious to that child.
Oh, yeah.
Because then they feel the pressure of that, like you can't believe, from a very young age. So also then seek the help. You seek the help from your pediatrician that you trust. Go, hey, what do you think about this? Or from a friend maybe that has a neurodivergent child, or with a counselor or something like that, to work through your thought process about this. And then if you get in the school, once a child's in school, but some kids do best with early intervention, and there are going to be some things that show up by the time they're two or three.
Okay.
Okay. And you're looking for extreme speech delays. You're looking for maybe sleep starts falling apart during this time. Possibly you see a hyperactive kind of situation going on. Possibly you see the inability to attend, follow directions. Those things can be signals at the age of two. So there's nothing wrong with a kid getting a referral to speech, say, when they're two. That's generally where you start, is with some kind of a speech and language kind of intervention. And our own grandson was delayed in speech, and now you'd never believe it. He's years below above grade level. He's, you know, all these things. So just as long as you keep yourself calm and go, most of the time there's an intervention. Kids' development is so all over the map from birth to age five.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Right? Because you've got some kids, the verbal strengths come on like crazy, but they can't do a puzzle. You've got other kids that can ride a bike, and another one falls down when they walk. You know, it's just but at the end, it kind of all levels out about third grade.
Okay.
So, however, you're going to see things develop over time. Sometimes there's a little thing, but nobody, if your insurance will pay for it, no child gets hurt through speech and language. Like for my grandson, we kind of think part of it was that he was a COVID child. And where they lived, everything shut down. So he had no playmates. He had no preschool to go to. Yeah. He had nothing. And so he didn't talk to anybody. And adults are always busy to talk for kids. So we really think that that was it. And once he figured out he could, it was like there was no stopping him, you know. And so there's so many reasons why those things can happen. But do seek help for yourself to understand what's going on. Try to prevent yourself from comparing to your other children in a way that may be unhealthy. I think comparison is good because you have a typical thing and then you have this other situation that doesn't seem as typical to you. Never be ashamed of your questions. Never be ashamed to ask for help, to talk to your counselor, to talk to the pediatrician. If they're in preschool, talk to the preschool teacher. They will often tell you. Remember, they see lots and lots of kids.
Yeah, they do.
So that's where you have to trust. If they go, no, I think she's okay, trust it for then, but also always follow your instinct, because earlier is better than later in almost everything. Almost everything. And what's tricky is that sometimes for some people that hormonal shifts, say people that are OCD, it may appear just fine until they get into a hormonal puberty period. Mm-hmm. And then it will escalate or it will decrease. You don't know, because there's a huge brain thing that goes on at puberty. And so then you go, oh, this is really a thing. Well, I always saw a few little things growing up, but it didn't interfere with anything.
Yeah.
They did well in school. They were happy. But then you go, oh, now this all makes sense.
Okay.
So, but anyway, I hope that kind of, it's a very complex answer, but don't ever be afraid to seek help. Don't think, no, it's fine. If you're worried, then ask somebody.
Yeah.
Just straight up, just ask somebody.
Okay. And if you have, so your kid's going into school, you think they, like, you're pretty sure they have something. How do you advocate for your kid in school? Because I know that's a struggle sometimes.
It is. And often in schools, you know, the reality is that public school and private school sometimes is even more so, because private schools aren't always equipped with with teachers who, say, can address learning disabilities or who can whatever. Private schools are great in a million ways. And also for parents to know, I don't know Texas law, so this isn't helpful. But in some states, your child who's in a private school has a right to go get services at the public school.
Okay.
Like, say they need speech and language. So that's a question to ask. I wish I were more informed. I don't know. I've not worked in Texas in a long, long time. Also, if you're concerned, then I would start by have a meeting with the teacher and talk about your concerns. And they also see lots and lots of kids. And the range of typical is so broad with a five-year-old.
Oh, man, at five, yeah.
Yeah, it just is. So you think about entering school as kindergarten. So sometimes it becomes a bit of a wait and see. And you may feel impatient about that. So if you feel impatient, again, talk to people. And so the way you advocate is you just stay in communication. Sometimes advocacy, because I have worked as an advocate for people at times, sometimes advocacy is viewed as a hostile takeover, you know, like, you know, I worked in a school district, everybody came with an attorney.
Yeah.
And as I told it's just the nature of where we lived around DC. So, so I tell teachers who were super nervous and I go, they're an attorney. We're following the law. We know education, the attorney doesn't. So don't worry about it.
Yeah.
If we're not breaking the law, we're fine. Yeah. So, but that's real, right? And so it's got this, so teachers can sometimes feel like all this pressure's on them from the outside and they're doing the best they can. So again, continue conversation with your teacher. Counselors are a great resource in the school that many parents don't know about. You can't or don't think of first. Talk to your teacher, but then talk to the teacher and say, hey, what would you think if I just contacted the school counselor? It's best to start with the teacher. That's respectful.
Yeah.
And so then you move from teacher to counselor, and that way the counselor can double back with the teacher and go, so what do you see going on in the classroom? And so sometimes it may be a little intervention plan that doesn't mean they're special ed or doesn't mean any of that. They just maybe need a little extra support in a certain area, and a counselor can help with that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, that's good. So again, communication, listening.
Yes, communication, talking. Listening, and to examine ourselves and go, what's our motivation here?
That's a good one.
You know, are we all doing a comparison? I've had parents come in and say, there's something wrong with my son because he's making B's and C's. And we're going, there's absolutely nothing wrong with your son. He's just not your daughter who was here before that you're thinking about. Public school's job is to take your child where they are and to help them learn what they need to know and to be able to do what they need to be able to do to live a functioning, productive life. They are not there for the purpose of always making your child accelerated or in a gifted program or whatever, because that's not their role. And parents can want that for their children. But so if you should get a diagnosis, pediatrician, again, is sometimes the first person to notice it before you get to school. So you can even bring any records or reports or anything from a pediatrician. Some of these neurodivergencies, there's actually going to be a medical component that's required from the school district based on state law and federal law to get any kind of help. You can't just walk in and say, my kid's got a little lisp, I want him to have speech. No, it's a whole assessment process, and that's federal law, and that's for kids' protection. That's so my kids, who are migrant farm workers' kids who didn't speak English, didn't wind up with a special education label for their entire life.
Yeah.
Right? It's really for protection. It can feel limiting, like, why can't you help me? But it's actually for your protection, so things don't get out of hand.
Yeah.
You know? But, so I hope that answers the question.
Oh, yeah,
it's very broad and very big.
Yeah.
But if you do get a diagnosis, like I said, if your pediatrician says something, take that paperwork to the school and ask that it be added to their file.
Okay. Good to know.
Any parent can add things to a file.
Yeah.
So do that. And that way anybody getting your child can look in there and go, oh, okay. Because maybe the thing that the parent's noticing doesn't really come into play academically until, say, second grade. right? Mm-hmm. And maybe they're doing fine. They're doing fine. And then when things get a little harder towards second and third grade, that may be when it shows up. And so if you have some record of that, but that annual meeting with, or twice a year is super important just to keep everybody in front of everybody's mind and attention.
Okay. Good to know.
Yes.
So if, you know, there is a neurodivergent kid, a family, how is a good way to support parents, the kid? You were talking about fear. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of us do. Like, I don't know what to do. Yes. So you just kind of go away and it's never addressed. And how do you, make it a comfortable space for like the parent to be able to talk about it, you to be able to talk to them about it if they want to, and not to be shameful or anything, because God made that child how that child is supposed to be. And how do we just love?
Yes. Well, again, there's so many components to this for the adults and for the child, in that the child, it's interesting. Some research has shown that children who know that they're neurodivergent, which just means I think differently, actually try harder, do better, and want to know how to help themselves.
Interesting.
Because they know.
That's really neat.
Which is better than feeling I'm just stupid.
Yeah.
Or I can't do anything. I do everything wrong. So a lot of it becomes education of the teachers. It becomes just education of everybody involved. Uh-huh. So as a parent of a neurodivergent child, you look at what's developmentally appropriate and one. But even from the age of five, you can start saying, you know, you're smart. You're able to do things. This is just harder for you. And so we're going to give you some help in this. That's all you need to say. You keep it simple. And they go, oh, okay. And then you give examples like, you know, you can ride a bike really well. And your friend, Marcus, he can't ride his bike at all. Just because you're better at riding your bike. That's harder for him. We're all different.
Yeah.
So but keep it that simple. But it's not, but sometimes our own shame, but also it releases you of shame. Tell your friends, tell your circle at church. There's such huge circles of support. So if you want to support somebody, start in your own circle. I think walking up to somebody you don't know, right, it's just rude anyway, and because you're all in their business. Yeah. And they're going, get out of my business. But so start with the people you know, and just instead of how can I help you, how can I support you? And generally, people can tell you what they need. Sometimes they may say, if you could, you're really good. I've got to do a chart of chores or a schedule chart for my child. Uh-huh. They recommended that for her ADHD, that we have a chart at home. I'm not good at that. Will you help me? Right. Sometimes it's as simple as the super practical things that they need to execute to make their home life better and make school life that they're doing at school, that they may just need a friend to come and do it with them.
Yeah.
You know, it can be as simple as that.
Yeah.
But mostly get rid of the shame. You'll never know what you did wrong. I think that many parents go, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And then you start overanalyzing every Coke you drank when you were pregnant and you should have. You start overanalyzing, oh, I probably shouldn't have eaten so many of this, or, oh, you know, I probably shouldn't have done that. And, oh, I probably don't do that, because nobody knows.
Yeah.
that is, there are sometimes some familial, not hereditaries, but links. But they don't know. Is that nature or nurture? Yeah. Is it because there's some genetic predisposition, which some people it expresses and some people it doesn't? Or is it that just the household you grew up in maybe was somebody with this neurodivergence, and that it impacted your growing up and how you mm-hmm. viewed the world? So that we don't know. Nobody knows. But what's great is we do know now how we can help people.
Yes, that's, and I feel like we're doing
that's the best part of all of it. Absolutely.
I love something you said earlier about maybe to like the parents getting counseling. Yes. Like, we always think like, okay, the kid needs to go to therapy. We need to try to talk them through this. But like the parents going to counseling too, like that could be helpful. And I love that you said that, because I never thought about that. Like, yeah,
well, maybe because if you have a neurodivergent child, and especially one when they're little, some of these behaviors seem more extreme. And you're exhausted. They're not sleeping. Yeah. You know, you've got other children. You're trying to manage life. You possibly have a job. I mean, there's just so many things going on that you need support. The parent needs support to be the parent they need to be through all of this. So if you find yourself, examine your thinking. If you find yourself riddled with guilt and self-doubt, especially, go get help. and go get support. There's a lot of online forums, which I would say, if people are writing stuff at 2 a.m, I would take it with a grain of salt because, you know, they're probably venting out about their life or they're doing something. But there's a lot of very helpful online forums through the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, through the Mayo Clinic, through even local resources here. So just Google it and find, and if you find a group that you don't like, then go on to another one. There's lots and lots of personal social resources and groups that meet.
Yeah. Well, that's very good.
Yes.
So I would just, as a church, just when we have neurodivergent people, just supporting and communication and love.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just all of those things. I do think it's, I think also, I may be going into treacherous territory here, but I'm going to say it as a former preacher's wife for a lot of years and having grown up in churches most of my life. Sometimes as Christians, we put an overlay of guilt on ourselves that we should be able to do everything.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah.
So if it involves a child, I'm supposed to be involved. If it you know, if this is a friend of mine, if you don't know what your personal skills and strengths and limits are. Like if you can go to coffee and be a crying shoulder, that's huge. If you can maybe have this child over for a play date starting at 30 minutes at a favorite place, that's huge. You don't have to solve the problem. You don't have to do any of that. You just be there and you go, wow, she needs a break. I'm going to give her a break. Even if it's I go to her house, where the child's more comfortable, say if it's an autism spectrum or OCD or any a variety of things, I go there for an hour and let her just go take a walk. I mean, there's so many ways. Now, if you're a teacher or you're a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a physician or a neurologist or a pediatrician, or like me, I was an educator, we have a different set of knowledge and skills. So then what we can do is we can actually, which I do at times, and I'm glad to do, if this is going to some people in church, I'm glad to do this for anyone. I just go to meetings and I can sit there because I have an educated ear and I know what I'm listening to. There's a lot of jargon. And there's a lot of law and there's a lot of edu-speak. There's just a lot of that. And it can make you feel, parents who are very highly educated can feel so stupid in those situations, and you don't want to admit you don't understand. And so I can go there and just be a listening ear and help interpret and help advocate. Say, so, you know, this child used to get this and now they only get this. Why? Show me the data. I want to see the records. I want to see the assessments, right?
Yeah.
I can do that. And so think about what you know and what you can do and how you're able maybe to help in a different way. That I can do with a stranger. Right.
Yeah.
So just, I think it's, and then, so maybe someone who's not an educator knows somebody, well, then they know that I am. So go, hey, Jeanette, could you go talk to them? It's just using your network and thinking about the people you know and what they're able to do, but nobody can do it all.
And not taking it all on.
Right. You can't do it all. I'm not at this stage of my life, probably going to be the one that goes and sits in somebody's house, you know, and while they go for a walk, unless I really know them well.
Yeah.
Right? Because the kid's not going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
The parent's not going to be comfortable.
I feel like you have to know them to be able to do that.
Exactly. But other things I can do and really not know them that well on a personal level. So just know what you're good at and don't push yourself to do something that is out of your comfort zone. If you do anything, it is better than nothing.
Yeah.
And I do believe God will tell you what people need and people will tell you what they need. If we think about not looking and going, well, here's what they need. Don't decide what they need. Let them tell you what they need.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Absolutely. This was great fun. And I talk way too much. I'm very passionate about this.
No, I love it. I learned a lot of new things today.
Oh, well, good.
So thank you.
Well, good. I'm glad. I was hoping to be blessed, which I was, by getting to know you and be a blessing. So
yeah,
I think God answered that prayer.
Yes, for sure. Thank you.
Okay, absolutely. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.